The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Glory, America, and Happy New Year. I am Hugh Hewitt. So glad to have you with me as the dawn of the new year breaks out over America. Thank you for being your new year with us. I hope you had a wonderful New Year's Day and a terrific football and that everything is good in your life. Your New Year's resolution should include going immediately to HughHewitt.com and ordering my brand new book, The Fourth Way. The Fourth Way is everything the Republicans have got to do. The playbook for the next 6 months. That will lead into victories 2 years from now. How to turn this country around, how to turn the economy around. That's your number one New Year's resolution. Go and do it right now. The Fourth Way by Hugh Hewitt. It's over at HughHewitt.com. And a special broadcast for you today, a Hillsdale dialogue that stretches out over 3 hours, the rest of our march through history, which we begin on the last broadcast day of the year with Dr. Larry Arnn, president of Hillsdale College. All things Hillsdale available at HughForHillsdale.com, HughForHillsdale.com. But, of course, Dr. Arnn will be new to some of you because I get to pick up new stations at the beginning of the year. That's perhaps where we should begin with exactly who it is we are talking with and what college we are talking about before we launch into the ideas.
So let's start with Hillsdale. Describe for those who are just tuning in for the first time in this epic broadcast what Hillsdale is and its mission.
Hillsdale is a liberal arts college located in southern Michigan. It's old. It was founded before the Civil War. And its distinction early was that it was one of the forces, one of the few important forces that helped to found the Republican Party and bring Abraham Lincoln to power. And it had more of its sons go and fight for the Union Army in the Civil War than any college except West Point, where they all had to go. Nearly all of our boys went. And we were small and young then. The distinction today is we try to stick as close as we can to that original idea of the liberal arts college that really is refined and, in my opinion, perfected by the American Revolution. If you're going to have a society where people govern themselves, you need liberally educated people, people who thought about the highest things and understand them, in order to equip them for rule, for leadership, for citizenship. And we stick very close to that. We refuse, an amazing thing to do, every penny that the federal government offers us, and because of that, we don't have to put up with any of the commands that they give, which are many and numerous and often vile. And so it's a singular kind of place.
How many students are enrolled there?
We have 1,150 students. It's a small liberal arts college. We believe that you can't do the job on a big scale. If you come to Hillsdale, you'll spend your first year and a half studying the same thing that every student studies here. It begins with two readers, one called Western Heritage and one called American Heritage, where we go through most of the works that we're talking about here on this program. And you study the great books, you study the tradition of rhetoric, you study the sciences, and you'll do that in classes that have 12 or 14 or 15 people in them.
Wow. Your faculty?
I'm sorry?
Who are your faculty?
Well, we have 110 people. We have a ratio of 11 to 1 between students and faculty. That's very good. And these people are splendid teachers and scholars who, as a body, are closely united around the original mission of the college. I'll name a couple. Probably our most popular teacher is the dean of the social sciences division. His name is Tom Connor, and he teaches a course on the First and Second World Wars every year that they're hanging from the rafters, and it's hard to get into the course. And in the summer, he often takes kids to go visit the battlefields. We have a professor in Christian studies who teaches C.S. Lewis. His name is Michael Bauman. It's the devil to get into that course. I don't know if I could get into that course, although I want to go sometime. We just hired a young man named Andrew Cuneo in English, who also wrote his doctoral thesis on C.S. Lewis. Over in the sciences, we have some biologists and chemists and physicists that are just fabulous, and the kids flock to them and have dinner at their house and hang out all the time.
Are you shuttling along there at too many applications and not enough seats?
Well, we're very selective, and we're becoming increasingly more so. We're looking for students who have good characters and good minds, and a Hillsdale education is a specific kind of thing.
Now, Hillsdale also puts out, and I'm going to either mispronounce it twice or pronounce it correctly on the first go, Imprimis. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Everybody who works for Hillsdale College says Imprimis, which means in the first place. But if you don't say Imprimis and you say Imprimis, that's fine, too.
Well, Imprimis, then, although I do not work for Hillsdale College, is a monthly letter or a newsletter. What would you call Imprimis? I've been getting it for years.
It's a speech digest. What we have three national conferences around about the country every year, and we get famous people to come. And we have four series of seminars each year on the campus, plus we have convocations and commencements. And because of those various events, some of the most famous people in the world come and talk for Hillsdale College. So we've had Ronald Reagan in Imprimis and Justice Thomas recently and Margaret Thatcher recently. And it's a lot of people like that. Tony Snow is in the current issue.
I think Mark Helprin did an Imprimis at the end of last year, which was really quite breathtaking. Am I correct in remembering that?
Mark spoke at we have an annual dinner in honor of Winston Churchill every year in Washington, D.C., around the time of Churchill's birthday, which is November 30th. This year the speaker was Jesse Helms. He'll be in the next Imprimis. And last year the speaker was Mark Helprin. And Mark Helprin, who, as you know, is a novelist, an award-winning novelist. He also writes powerful articles for the press, especially
and he's a
for
soldier.
The Wall Street Journal. And he's a genius, and he's a good friend of mine. And
oh, I didn't
know
that.
Very powerful writer.
Yeah. And so anyone who is listening can order Imprimis, can't they? And they get it for free.
It's free.
1.5 million copies you send out. That's quite a postage bill.
1,200,000 a month.
Oh, well, we'll get it up there then.
And we at Hillsdale, not only do we refuse the federal taxpayer dollar, but it's also true that we are long for the day when the post office can be privatized and there can be real competition, so our postage bill will go down.
Imprimis can be ordered. You can be added to their list by dialing 1-800-437-2268. That's 1-800-437-2268. And I want to emphasize, there's absolutely no cost, no obligation. They just like to disseminate ideas. Am I correct, Dr. Arn?
And we never give our mailing list to anybody else. So you won't get a pile of mail because you sign up for Imprimis.
You'll just get good ideas. Well, let's turn to good ideas. When last we left off, we were talking about Augustine, the great saint of the late decline of the Roman Empire. And we're going to flash forward a little bit to his successor as doctor of theology in the church, Aquinas. Tell us a little bit about Thomas.
Well, Thomas Aquinas is an Italian. He went to seminary. He met the great thinker, theologian Albert Magnus. He was a big, heavyset, taciturn man in speech. And so they gave him in seminary the appellation Dumb Ox. G.K. Chesterton has written a fabulous essay about Thomas Aquinas called Aquinas the Dumb Ox. Aquinas was a prolific author. He wrote huge books, the most famous being the Summa Theologica, my favorite being the Summa Contra Gentiles. That means the summation of the case against the heretics or the non-believers. The word Gentiles looks like Gentiles. But there's also a book he wrote, that book is, and the Summa Theologica have both been excerpted from in some small volumes, my favorite of those being Treatise on the Law, which is taken mostly from entirely from the Summa Theologica, and it's about the different kinds of law, including the natural law. And then the last thing I'd mention is Thomas wrote, he began at the end of his life, a summation of the Summa Theologica. The Summa Theologica is a difficult work because it's written in the form of the disputed question.
Boy, is that an understatement.
It's wonderful. Now, the Summa Contra Gentiles, which I like better, partly for this reason, is written in a treatise form. It's just he makes arguments about things. He makes arguments about everything. But he tried to summarize the Summa Theologica in a book called The Light of Faith, which is itself a fairly weighty book, but it's just one volume. And it is simpler, and it's arranged according to the order of faith, hope, and charity, the three Christian virtues. And that's a wonderful book to read. And
why do we care, with a minute to our break, why do we care about Aquinas anymore, this difficult bookmaker?
The classical world contained a lot of wisdom and not Jesus Christ. And so after Jesus Christ, something had to be done about that wisdom. It had to come to be understood anew in light of the revelation of Jesus Christ. Thomas Aquinas, especially in regard to the philosopher Aristotle, is the most important man in that enterprise. More important, I believe, than Augustine, and different from Augustine. And if you want to examine the question of what the virtue, the status of the virtues, the status of man is, according to human reason, after the revelation of Jesus, everyone should read Thomas Aquinas.
On that note, we take our first break on this part four of the special edition of the Hugh Hewitt Show on New Year's Eve and New Year's Day. We are walking through the great thinkers of Western civilization with Dr. Larry Arnn, president of Hillsdale College. When we return to the Italian Machiavelli. Don't go anywhere. This is the Hugh Hewitt Show. Hi, Hugh Hewitt for ReliefFactor.com. If you are in pain and you want out of pain, well, you need to talk to the people that get it done. Pete and Seth Talbot, the father-son owners of ReliefFactor.com. They tell me that sometimes whole families can be helped when one member of the family gets out of pain. For example, finally, a married couple gets to sleep through the night again when one isn't tossing and turning with a terrible back. That's why Pete and Seth created the 3-week quick start, so you can find out if those people are you. For about $1 a day, you can see if you can get out of pain, and after that, lessen the cost of a cup of coffee a week to stay out of pain. The 3-week quick start is like a trial pack, and it can be at your door in about 2 to 3 days. Let's face it, getting older, exercise, even everyday living can create discomfort, pain. You don't order Relief Factor just for yourself. Order it for your wife, your husband, your family, your friends. They miss the old you, too. 3-week quick start at ReliefFactor.com or call 800-500-8384, 800-500-8384. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt on the special edition of The Hugh Hewitt Show. Thank you for listening. Originally taped for airing on December 31st and January 1st of the new year, 2001-2002. We are joined by Dr. Larry Arnn, president of Hillsdale College, as we walk through sort of the cliff notes, even a bare-bones cliff notes of that, of the great thinkers of Western civilization, so that you can accomplish your New Year's resolution early this year by at least learning a little bit more than you knew last year. Machiavelli, I sat through weeks and weeks of lectures on Machiavelli by a fellow named Harvey Mansfield, a professor of political theory at Harvard. And he always spoke of Machiavelli reverentially. He wrote a great deal about him as well as of the break. And there I was banging my little sophomore head against the table. What is this break? What is this break? So why is Machiavelli referred to in the same breath as the break, Dr. Arnn?
Well, you studied with the best man on that subject that there is. He's a friend of mine, as of yours, and a great man. What it means is that Machiavelli decided to attempt to change the focus of philosophy. He criticized the ancients for their attempt to construct imaginary republics, for their attempt to understand how men ought to be. What he wanted to do instead was dwell upon how they are. He wished to give up the question of the good and concentrate more on the question of the useful. This break, this change, has had profound implications for thought and for the world we live in, all every respect of our lives. The first and most famous thing about Machiavelli is that there is an adjective that made out of his name that refers to a kind of politics, Machiavellian. And I'll give you an example of why that phrase represents justly something that is in Machiavelli. In Book 7, Chapter 7 of Machiavelli's most famous work, it's short, it's easy to read, it's very powerful, it's called The Prince. Machiavelli tells a story that is the classic story of Machiavellianism. There, Duke Valentino has conquered Romagna, and there are a host of petty tyrants there, and he has to submit them to his rule. And so he sends a man named Ramiro d'Orco there, a man of exceptional cruelty, who works a terror upon the population and reduces it to subservience to Valentino. But then after the cruelties have all been worked and the subservience is established, Valentino then goes, puts Ramiro Dorcor to death by quartering him, and puts his severed body on display in the public square, winning thereby the affection of the people that he had previously, upon whom he had previously worked a terror. Now, there's a lot of things like that in Machiavelli.
Yeah,
he's a very amusing
story.
Reading, especially to the young man.
Yeah, yes.
But you have to see that what's going on in classical philosophy is an attempt to find a standard of right to which we could conform that would be eternal and outside us. Classical philosophy looks up. Machiavelli looks at us. He's interested in making us better, but he derives the idea of what constitutes better by a study of the conditions around us now, understanding both the evil and the potential for good in men. This question of the good is called into question, both by things that Machiavelli says, like what I just told you, but also by his whole approach, and that's what constitutes the break. Let us look at this world. Let us give up on worlds that do not exist.
Well, then I have to ask, well, we will sometime today get to a fellow by the name of Madison, who wrote, if men were angels, no government would be necessary. Does that make Madison a Machiavelli?
Certainly not. Madison's quote, the burden of that quote, which is one of the most beautiful quotes in the Federalist Papers, if, you know, what is government but the profoundest of all reflections on human nature? If men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither internal nor external controls on the government would be needed. Madison's quote is a quote oriented by the distinction between the man and the angel, just as the Declaration of Independence is oriented by the distinction between God and man. And so, it is not only the demands and the pressures of this world that give rise to his thinking, it's also with an eye to the higher world that he defines his politics.
Stay right there, America. I'll be right back. We'll talk more about Madison as we walk through history with Dr. Larry Arnn of Hillsdale College. All the Hillsdale Dialogue is available at q4hillsdale.com. Everything Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu. Stay with us on this first broadcast day of the new year. You're listening to the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt, first broadcast day of the year. Remember, your New Year's resolution should be to go to HughHewitt.com, order The Fourth Way, my brand new book that will guide the Republican Revolution. They also need to be reading Machiavelli. That's why I'm talking about Machiavelli with Dr. Larry Arnn, president of Hillsdale College. All things Hillsdale available at hillsdale.edu. Every one of these dialogues for 4 years, all collected, binge listen at Hugh4Hillsdale.com. Back to Machiavelli.
And Machiavelli had no eye cast up at all?
Well, no, that wouldn't be true to say, and Harvey Mansfield would shudder, I fear, at my entire performance in this thing. I want to repeat here my humility that it is my position, learned from my teacher, Harry Jaffa, that no man can really learn well more than 3 great books, and even that's very difficult. So I protest that most of what I'm talking about I don't really know, but I say that for such as Harvey Mansfield in particular. But no, Machiavelli is a contemporary of Martin Luther. And Machiavelli sees some problems that have developed in part because of the birth of Jesus and the spread of Christianity. All of a sudden, the idea grows that because there is one God for every man, then the authority to rule, to govern, comes from God. And there were abuses in church governance, which spread beyond merely spiritual matters, that were very, very difficult to correct. It's taken a long time to correct them. In my opinion, the United States of America and its doctrines are the correction of them.
I have to go back to part one of our conversation when you were talking about your teacher, Harry Jaffa. He said that he had read 3 great books, and one was The Ethics, and the other was the Bible, and the third he left unnamed. Could that third have been The Prince?
No, I think the question is more, I think Plato's Republic is included.
Oh, you're right, it wasn't.
And then the Bible, or Shakespeare, or I guess it's really a contest between those two. Of course, I've speculated on this for years.
Yes, but it's not The Prince.
He said, no, not for him it wouldn't be. It could be for Harvey. I don't know. I'd have to ask Harvey that. He would give me a cryptic answer just like Harry Jaffa would.
What about The Republic, Machiavelli's other great work?
Well, it's a different kind of thing than Plato's Republic. The distinction between it And, you know, all of Machiavelli's works, The Prince and The Discourses included, The Discourses on Livy, Machiavelli's idea about how to study politics is not to construct a regime of perfection and then measure the ones we have by it. It is emphatically to eschew that idea. And so these books seem very different than, all of his books seem very different than reading Plato, and especially Plato, and any of the classics.
Dr. Arne, Martin Luther, big subject for 5 minutes. Tee it up.
Well, Luther is born in 1483 in Germany. He becomes a monk. He goes to Rome. He notices that Rome is a very worldly place. And by worldly, I mean sort of the way Washington, D.C. is today at its worst, involved in power. And
full
wealth.
Of whisperings.
Yeah, that's right. He is appalled by what he sees. The famous thing is the selling of indulgences. That is to say, there's an argument that's very important in the Reformation about the nature of church authority. That's one of a few arguments. Let me see if I can name them that's going on there. There's the nature of church authority. There's the relationship between faith and works as a means of salvation. That calls into question the standing of the virtues and the vices. The doctrines at the time that Luther came are really derived from the passage in Matthew, which says, who do you say that I am? And Peter replies, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus replies to him, roughly, I don't have it in front of me, but upon the art Peter, Peter is Petra, the Greek word for stone, and upon this rock I will build my church. And what you bind on earth, I will bind in heaven. And what you loose on earth, I will loose in heaven. And the special place of the apostles in carrying on Jesus' teaching, and this particular thing, gives rise to the idea that it is bishops, that is to say, the descendants of the apostles who have had their hands laid upon them, who carry within a special way the message of Jesus down through the ages, and that the successors of Peter, who became the bishop of Rome, are the key key representatives of God on earth. That's the Catholic, Roman Catholic doctrine. Now, what that means, though, is that you have power. And one of the things that grew up that was a terrible corruption was this idea that if you pay money to a priest, maybe to the church and maybe to the priest personally, your sins will be forgiven. In other words, do him a favor. And that corruption, by the way, is skewed by the Reformed Catholic Church that we have today. I myself understand the Pope, the current Pope, John Paul II, to be a very great man. And these arguments are very serious arguments. Well, Luther saw all that, and he rebelled against it. And that led him, in a long series of works, I think his translated works into English take up 56 volumes, that led him to develop a new way of understanding church authority and the relationship between faith and works. These two things are related, by the way, because if the church has authority and if works, that is to say, things that you do are important to your salvation, that gives the church some authority to control your behavior.
He was also, though, not just a revolutionary, but he was really quite a reactionary when it came to government on this planet over people like the peasant revolt in his regions of Germany.
That's right. And what would be fair to say, you know, Luther was a conservative, you know, it's not a very good word, conservative. I'm one, but, I can say what I mean when I say that I'm a patriot. What I mean when I'm a conservative is that I want to keep certain doctrines alive. And I can name what they are. Luther was of a conservative temper. He did not wish to upset the German society. He was not, nor was Calvin, his blood brother and near contemporary. Neither of them would characterize themselves as political thinkers, as having an idea about how to govern. They thought, in general, taking passages from the Bible, that just about anybody in power, if he was in power, was put there by God, and that even the worst tyrant could not extinguish faith or attack faith. And so his politics are they're not worked out the way some Christian thinkers' politics have been. My own opinion is that is a failing of a kind. And I'll get to that when we get to the American Revolution.
You did not mention Francis Bacon, and I don't know anything about Francis Bacon. Why did you pick him? What do we need to know?
I picked him because of one word, science. Bacon is a development on Machiavelli that leads to the understanding of science in the sense of modern science, technology. Bacon's chief works are The New Atlantis and The New Organum, Novum Organum. He also wrote a utopian work. Bacon agrees with Machiavelli that we have to concentrate on the here and the now. But he adds something, and that is, what do people want in the here and the now? Who do they admire? What do they love? Are they grateful for their heroes, or are they grateful for the people who help them? The expression, the relief of man's estate, is born in Bacon. And Bacon foresees a time in which there will be enormous energy poured into that, and that we will have science bended to the job, not of discovering the greatest and deepest and most fundamental truth, but of being serviceable.
He is born in 1561. He dies in 1626, so this makes him an Elizabethan.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. And the Renaissance is going on. And it's a, you know, there's a ferment underway, you know, because if you look at, if you go back and you look at the doctrines of Plato's Republic, for example, what they're doing is something that issues in the end in a series of questions. And the account of the good life that is implicit, it's not explicit, but implicit in Plato's works is, a good life is a life of argument about the highest things. Where that argument ends, you don't get a doctrinaire statement. You get more of that in Aristotle, but not in Plato. Well, this is the opposite idea. This is serviceability. This is usefulness. And it is very powerful in Bacon. And Bacon makes, of course, a very, very powerful point.
I'm not getting this. You think Bacon is important because he stresses that we ought to put science in the harness and make it make the lights down at night.
He's one of the way stations along the way of modern philosophy. And remember, Machiavelli turns from elevation to usefulness in his politics. Here is the introduction of a tool of usefulness that has become, of course, one of the defining things in our lives. Why, you ask yourself, do we care about the Taliban? 100 years ago, we would not have known their names. But it is because of science that they can strike us, and we can strike them back. The world is remade by a spirit, an energy, a method, an enterprise that is really articulated first and clearly in the works of Bacon.
And it is a very spare, just the facts, ma'am, the launch of the scientific method.
Yeah, you could say that, but remember, that implies something, remember. That implies what is the high, you know, because philosophy, that means the love of wisdom. And wisdom, Aristotle says, is knowledge of the things that do not change. And so each of these people that we're talking about are giving an account of the highest things. They're giving a great account of those things. And so implicit in this turn to the usefulness of modern science is this idea that that is indeed the highest thing, usefulness. Usefulness to what? Usefulness to our love of honor, our sense of justice? No. Usefulness to our comfort, our preservation, our prosperity. Remember what Spock in Star Trek always says. What's his greeting and his farewell? Live long and prosper. So length and wealth are the things about life. But of course they're not. It's in it, you know, why are we all going around wearing caps and T-shirts that say FDNY? The people,
you're right.
those, Those firemen who went up in that building did not live long, and they are not prosperous today, except in honor and service to right. There is a narrowing of the perspective that goes on here.
Honor and service to right. That is what we are about on this, the first broadcast day of the year. Hugh for Hillsdale.com. If you're just tuning in, you say, man, I wish I had all this conversation. It's over there. Hugh for Hillsdale.com. All things Hillsdale at Hillsdale.edu. Stick around. I'll be right back with Dr. Larry Arnn on The Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. First broadcast day of the brand new year. It's my tradition to spend it with Dr. Larry Arnn, president of Hillsdale College, if you're just tuning in. 4 hours have already gone by on the last broadcast day of the year in this first hour, but you are here in time. We are crescendoing. We are getting close. Don't forget your New Year's resolution. Head over to HughHewitt.com. Order my brand new book, The Fourth Way, Indispensable. Most important book I've ever written. A guide to what we've got to do in this year with this new president, with this new Congress, and how to make it all work and to do so in an honorable fashion. That's why we're spending so much time with Dr. Arnn today talking about honor, talking about what you need to do to maintain your honor. All these conversations, by the way, collected at HughForHillsdale.com. Everything Hillsdale, including great courses on the Constitution, are all collected at Hillsdale.edu, and you can sign up there for Imprimis, the speech digest. Let's get back to our conversation about honor with Dr. Larry Arnn, president of that august institution, the Lantern of the North, Hillsdale College.
But now Bacon is part of the court which feasted on honor. Elizabeth addressed to her sailors on the eve of the Armada, and it was all about honor. So is he apart from this whole Renaissance England thing?
I think so, and a part in it too. You know, I don't want anybody to get the sense that I'm in rebellion against the modern world, because I'm not. I just think that there are some strains in it that are very evil and dangerous and ultimately could mean the destruction of us all. And I think that it's an important thing. I also am not talking now in order to condemn Francis Bacon. I'm not. If you wish to understand the spirit that is behind modern technology, this is an excellent place to go and look.
Then I want to switch over then to someone who we talk about regularly on this program with a professor from the United States Naval Academy, David Allen White, who's really quite a genius at talking about Shakespeare. And so we know on this program why Shakespeare is here, but let's get launched on him. He's a contemporary of Bacon's, but he's kind of the opposite.
Well, Shakespeare is... there's a speech in the Symposium, played at one of Plato's dialogues, where they say that there'll be a poet who will have the genius both of comedy and of tragedy in him, and that this poet will be the greatest of the poets. Well, Shakespeare wrote three kinds of plays, comedy and tragedy, and a kind he invented, history plays. And these plays, and the sonnets too, but especially the plays, are... I mean, if you ask the learned world or the ordinary world, who is the greatest of the writers, there would be a consensus that it's Shakespeare.
Dr. Arnn, we're talking about Shakespeare as we conclude part four. Do you make the students at Hillsdale, are they obliged to take a course in Shakespeare?
Everybody has to read Shakespeare in our freshman core course on, it's a two-semester course taught by the English department. And so everybody reads a lot of Shakespeare. And
what do they begin with?
You know, I don't really know the answer to that.
What would you have them begin with?
Well, I'll tell you what my favorites are. I love the history plays. I'm a historian. I love The Tempest. I love Macbeth. Abraham Lincoln loved Macbeth. I'll mention a thing. You know, Winston Churchill knew Macbeth off by heart, and several of them as well. I was taking a course on Macbeth with Harry Jaffa. And
Would be a course.
We did Macbeth and King Lear. He's written about King Lear. By the way, King Lear, let me get it right, The Merchant of Venice and The Tempest are the three plays in which someone is described as a philosopher. That's an interesting study for somebody to undertake sometime. I remember we're reading Macbeth's description of his assassination of the King Duncan. And he began, and we're listening to somebody reading the play. Okay, it's a production of the play, and listening to them. Harry Jaffa is a big believer in that, and I commend that to anybody, to buy a recording of an excellent production of Shakespeare, not the pictures, just the words, and listen. It's fabulous. And follow along in the book. He describes the angels above crying out to him to stop, and the ghouls and devils below screaming for blood. And of course, you know, later comes this wonderful encapsulation of the whole meaning of justice in this even-handed justice commends the poison chalice to our own lips. Well, when we got to the part where the ghouls and they were all screaming from below, Harry Jaffa picked up the needle on the phonograph he was using, and all he said was, I remember it like it's yesterday, he said, "Does this man believe that there is a moral order or not?" And they put it back down, and on we went. And, you know, of course, that is the human condition, because we all believe in a moral order and cannot escape the belief of it. And we all have our failings.
When we come back in part five of this special edition of the Hugh Hewitt Show, we're going to talk, at least begin, with an English philosopher who thought quite clearly there was a moral order. A little bit afraid of it, I think, when we come back to Thomas Hobbes. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to a special edition of this program with Dr. Larry Arnn, president of Hillsdale College, and me, your host, Hugh Hewitt, on this, the New Year's edition of the Hugh Hewitt Show. Hi, Hugh Hewitt for ReliefFactor.com. If you are in pain and you want out of pain, well, you need to talk to the people that get it done. Pete and Seth Talbot, the father-son owners of ReliefFactor.com. They tell me that sometimes whole families can be helped when one member of the family gets out of pain. For example, finally, a married couple gets to sleep through the night again when one isn't tossing and turning with a terrible back. That's why Pete and Seth created the 3-week quick start, so you can find out if those people are you. For about $1 a day, you can see if you can get out of pain, and after that, lessen the cost of a cup of coffee a week to stay out of pain. The 3-week quick start is like a trial pack, and it can be at your door in about 2 to 3 days. Let's face it, getting older, exercise, even everyday living can create discomfort, pain. You don't order Relief Factor just for yourself. Order it for your wife, your husband, your family, your friends. They miss the old you, too. A 3-week quick start at ReliefFactor.com or call 800-500-8384. 800-500-8384.